Now we're starting with Roman numeral 7, the 5th century A.D. And under that, we will note A, the political situation to 460. I'm going to discuss the political situation of this first half of the century, a little more than half first, and then later on to discuss it in the last part, because up until about 450 to 460, you still, in parts of Europe at least, are in the ancient world. You still have the great Roman, Greco-Roman civilization. You have great numbers of people who can read and who can write and who can study. And you have groups of people discussing Christian doctrine very actively, and you have a high civilization. It is in process of dying, but there still is pretty good evidence of it being living until you get to about 460. The last third of the century, or more than a third, you have to really say the ancient world has died. I mentioned to you before how this big book, not this one, but one slightly larger than this, by Shaw, on the history of the Christian church from 300 to 600 A.D., 9/10 of all that is in the book deals with the 160 years from 300 to 460. And less than 1/10 deals with events between 460 and 590. It simply shows how when the world failed, the civilized world failed to keep up its defenses, failed to watch for the attacks and entrance of the barbarians, failed to watch to protect itself against being engulfed, civilization ended, and for nearly 1,000 years it almost disappeared. And if it had not been for the monastery in which a few people fleeing for their lives were able to keep up reading and writing and copying some things, we might not even know there'd ever been an ancient civilization. So complete and terrible was the devastation in Europe. But in the first two-thirds of the century, this is in process of occurring. We've already seen quite a little about it in connection with the fourth century or with the life of Augustine. We've noticed that it is not that these people were in any way inferior to the people of the Roman Empire of whom they destroyed. These people, members of these groups, had been received into the Roman Empire during the previous 5 or 6 centuries. Numbers of them in every decade had come in, usually been mercenary soldiers, then with their children would become Roman citizens, and a great part of the population of the Roman Empire was exactly the same blood as the so-called barbarians who overran the empire and destroyed civilization. But they had been taken in gradually. They had been assimilated. They had been educated. They had become full members of the Roman civilization. Now they were allowed to come in so rapidly, so many of them once, allowed simply because the Romans allowed their strength to deteriorate to the point where they could not stop it. They were allowed to come in so rapidly that they simply destroyed and changed the society, get away with the establishment, and put instead a situation where nobody had more than a fourth as much to eat and drink as practically everybody had before. And nobody had half or a third of the comfort of life that practically everybody had before. And that continued for nearly 1,000 years. You have a whole new development from this time on, a development which we'll have to look at this semester, so we'll look at it much more briefly than we have at the very important event we've been considering last semester. But of course we have a far longer stretch of time to cover. But we still are in the ancient civilization for maybe the next 2 or 3 weeks at least. And so under the political situation to 461, we mentioned number one, the divided empire. You remember that when Theodosius the Great died shortly before 400, his empire was divided between his two sons. And it really is a marvel when you think of the not having telegrams or airplanes or automobiles or any of the means of rapid communication that we have. It is a marvel that an empire as large as the Roman Empire should have continued and have existed. But under the difficult conditions during that previous century, time and again it has seemed necessary to have administrative authority in each, at least in two great centers of the empire instead of one. And so it was simply carrying along a tradition that had to some extent been started already when Theodosius II sons took over the power, one in the east and one in the west, but neither of them was a man of any special ability. They were not, like their father, a very, very able general and a very, very able emperor. And the result was that neither of them is of any particular importance to our history. But the fact that the Roman Empire then was divided and never again reunited is of importance. Because the attack came to a far less extent in the eastern part than in the western part. And so the eastern part continues for 50 or 60 years to be of considerable importance in our history. After that, it goes off in its own direction, and it has far less relation to us today, so we won't pay so much attention to it. But we will realize that a somewhat stable government continued until the Mohammedan conquest in the eastern part, and after that, in a much smaller territory. But in the west, the section of the Roman Empire, including just about all of Europe, except just the section around Constantinople, it was subject to the attacks by these people who forced their way into the empire and went on from place to place, plundering, marauding, and looking for a place to make their own permanent settlement. So much for number one, the divided empire. Number two, the sack of Rome. This we notice in connection with the life of Saint Augustine, that in 410, a group of so-called Western Goths, or Visigoths, sometimes spelled V-I-S-I-G-O-T-H, the Visigoths, or the Western Goths, one of these large Germanic tribes, which had come in from the area near where Romania is now, had made its way over part of Greece and then across into Italy and came down into Italy, and in 410 actually took the city of Rome and plundered it. And here we must be grateful for the work of Ulfilas, the missionary we noticed, who, even though he was an Arian, had won the Gothic nation to Arian Christianity. And so these people, these Visigoths, spared all the churches in Rome. And they did not kill anyone who took refuge in the church. And not only that, but their king had them under such control that he gave them only a few days to plunder and then led them out of the city. And so the plunder was, it was a terrible thing. There'd been nothing like it for 700 years in Rome. But still it was nothing to what it might have been and would have been if these folks had not already been Arian Christians. And this sack of Rome, as you remember, made such an effect on people's minds, and people said it's due to Christianity which has weakened the empire. They have turned away from their old God. And this is what led Augustine to write his great book, The City of God, the second greatest of his great works, and one from which we will have readings assigned during the course of this semester at various times. Now, number three, the Vandals. The Vandals. And here again, we covered this in connection with the life of Augustine, so I simply remind you of it at this point. Here was another Germanic tribe, and a tribe which was in itself no worse than the Romans themselves, no worse than any other group of people. In fact, one of the Vandals was practically the administrator of the Roman Empire, for the Western Empire, for a number of years, until finally, as a result of a plot by his enemies, he was executed, and that was what weakened Rome so that the Goths could take it and make their sack. So the Vandals in themselves were not any worse than any other group of people. But the Vandals here fell under leadership of very ruthless men. And they marched across Europe. They didn't come down into Italy. They went across to France, which was then called Gaul, and down into Spain, and after they had stayed in Spain for a time, they then went across to North Africa. 60,000 were in the group that went, probably 40,000 of them Vandals, 20,000 others who joined with them. And we notice how they conquered North Africa. And in the day of St. Augustine, at St. Augustine's death was in Hippo, when all the territory around was in the hands of Vandals. And all the material effects of Augustine's life seemed to have disappeared, because the city was besieged, and around it you could see the burning of houses, and you could hear the shrieks of those who were being attacked, and see the utter devastation that the Vandals were making in the whole area there in North Africa. After Augustine's death, the Vandals withdrew to face a Roman army, and the people of Hippo were able to escape to the sea. Then the Vandals came back, took Hippo, and destroyed it. And soon they had all of North Africa in their possession. This was 430, and in 450 they were strong enough, or a little after 450, I forget the exact date, they were strong enough to send ships across to Italy and to attack Rome and to plunder it, and to plunder it far more ruthlessly than had been done by the Goths in 410. There, the plundering by the Vandals was far worse. The Goths had said, these folks are Christians, and we must treat them in a Christian way. The Vandals said, these folks are Trinitarian Christians. They are wicked, and nothing is too bad. No way of treating them is too bad. And so they did terrible damage in Rome, damage from which Rome never recovered, really, until modern times. But in history, the Vandal sack of Rome receives not a fourth of the attention that the Gothic sack of Rome does, simply because the Gothic sack was the first time in 700 years that Rome had been taken by an enemy. And it had seemed absolutely impossible that such a thing could happen. Now we go on to number four, the Huns. Number four, the Huns. And I'm not sure that we know a great deal about what the real racial background of the Huns is. I don't know whether the name of Hungary is related to the name of the Huns at all or not. I don't know. But the Huns would seem to have been not a Germanic people. They came from somewhere in Central Asia. And they seem to have been much more ferocious than any of these Germanic peoples, even than the Vandals. There was a leader named Attila, A-T-T-I-L-A, who led the Huns, and who boasted that grass never grew again where his horse had trod. And he led a ravaging, pillaging army through many parts of Europe. He led shortly before the time of the Vandal plundering of Rome. He led his army right down through Italy, almost to Rome. Then something happened that he did not actually take Rome, but he turned his army and went back. There are those who say that the Bishop of Rome, a very able man at that time, whom we will discuss later, Pope Leo, one of the two popes who are usually called the Great, Leo I or Leo the Great, there are some who say that he paid a large sum of money to Attila to leave the city unplundered. There are others who say that Leo did most wonderful work negotiating with him and persuading him not to come in. There is another version of the story which you can see if you go to Rome today. This is the version of Raphael made 1,200 years later. I don't think Raphael knew anything particular about it, but his version shows what some people thought was good to present it anyway. In the Vatican Museum today, you can see a beautiful picture which shows Attila, a most ferocious-looking man, riding on a horse with others of his associates beside him, and it shows his horse rearing up and a look of utter terror on his face. Facing him, you see Pope Leo on a very mild-looking horse, and he's carrying a cross in his hand. He has two bishops beside him, a very peaceful-looking procession. They are riding out to meet Attila, and Attila, in terror, his horse is stepping back in terror, and you can see the awful look of consternation on his face. But you look up in the picture above Pope Leo, and there you see Peter and Paul flying through the sky, Paul shaking his sword at him and Peter shaking his keys at him, and that is Raphael's picture of driving back of Attila. Now, I don't think that there's anyone today who questions that it was something that Pope Leo did that led Attila to go back, whether it was a large gift of money, whether it was diplomacy, what it was, we don't know. But this has received far more publicity than the terrible plundering by the Vandals that took place only two or three years later than the time when Attila didn't come to Rome. But you can easily see why Italy, and in fact all of Europe, sank into degradation when you think that though Attila was the worst of the plundering forays, it was only one of many that went through Europe at this period. Attila's forces disintegrated after his death. They disintegrated and the Huns disappeared as a group, as far as I know. It was about 450, just a little after 450. The attack of the Huns made a great impression, but it left very little result except for that of which was destroyed by them. One interesting result of the coming of the Huns was that a group of people in northern Italy, terrified at the coming of the Huns, fled out to some islands in the Adriatic Sea, and thinking there they might be safe, they went out to these islands, and the Huns did not attempt to pursue them to them, and then, knowing that other groups might come similarly later, they proceeded to build homes on these islands, and that became the city of Venice, which became one of the great Italian cities of the Middle Ages, and which continued as an independent state until about 100 years ago, when it became a part of the nation of Italy. Now this was the Huns number four. Number five is events in Britain. Events in Britain. We're going to say more about France in the later period. France was overrun by these different groups one after another, but no group really permanently settled in France till the latter part of the century. But during this period, France was subject to these constant passing through of these different groups, and so civilization pretty much disappeared in France during this time. But now we want to speak of Britain. And you can imagine what the effect would be upon Britain, part of the Roman Empire before, of having the barbarians in complete control of France. It was only with difficulty that Romans could get to Britain to give them any special help, and the Romans had all they could do to protect themselves. The Britons had been a warlike people back in 50 BC when Julius Caesar had conquered them, but during the succeeding 450 years, they had been subject to the Romans, and a high Roman civilization had developed in Britain, and Britain had become a Christian nation. It is not England. The name England comes from later people who went there. But Britain, as we speak of it now, is substantially the same in area as the present England. That is to say, it is the southern half or two-thirds of the island of which England is today the southern half or two-thirds. And in this area, there were large Roman cities. You remember it was in the northern part of this area at the city of York that Constantine was proclaimed emperor by his troops. It was the area from which Pelagius had come, and many from this area had an important part in Roman history during this period. But the Romans were... during all this time, were protecting the people of Britain from the wild people to the north, the Picts and the Scots in the northern part of the area. And the Romans had, very early in the Christian era, had built a wall across the island, and they had Roman soldiers there to keep back the Picts and the Scots, who made ravaging forays on the northern part of England and drove away booty and kept that up off and on up until perhaps as late as 1600 A.D. But the Romans protected them from them, and now that the Romans were unable to protect them anymore, the Britons were in a pretty difficult situation. And so just what happened is not very certain. Some say that the Britons were attacked by Germanic tribes from northern Germany. Others say that the Britons invited these people in to protect them from the Picts to the north and to drive them back. Probably both were true to some extent. But if they did hire some of these people, these fighters, to come in and protect them, pretty soon they discovered that they could take over and didn't need to be subject to the Britons who'd hired them. And then the Britons began to fight in earnest. And so during the next 100 or 150 years, we have three Germanic troops which had not been reached by Ulfilas's missionaries at all, who came over from the northern part of what is now Germany. A group known as the Jutes was one of the groups, Angles was another, and the Saxons was perhaps the largest group. And the Saxons, the Angles, and the Jutes, many of them came over and settled in Britain, and they fought against the Britons, and they gradually drove the Britons back into the mountainous country of Wales. But during that 150 years, we have practically no evidence from Britain. There's hardly any evidence as to what was happening there. They were cut off entirely from the Roman world, and the next time we learn much detail about them, we have most of what is now England in the hands of these Saxon, Angle, and Jute peoples, and from them it eventually secured its name of England. Now the next division is important enough to give a large head to it. Capital B, the conversion of Ireland. The conversion of Ireland. All during the period, yes?
Before you go on, you were mentioning the dates that were around 100 years, 150 years ago.
Yeah.
Are you speaking in the vicinity of what?
From about 425 to about 575, approximately. We have no evidence about events in Britain during that period, except later reminiscences, of course, which are not at all dependent. But it's completely cut off from our records during that period. Now B is the conversion of Ireland. During the 450 years that Britain had been in Roman hands, there had been to the west of Britain the somewhat smaller island, but yet a very large island, of Ireland. And this island had been inhabited by small groups of people constantly fighting against each other. Different kings and rulers in different sections of it constantly fighting against each other. There may have been a small entrance of Christianity into that region during these 400 years of Christianity in Britain, or 300, whatever. We don't know when Christianity got into Britain, but it was very active there for a long period. But in Ireland, there was very little, if any, entrance of the gospel. Now, there's some who say there were a few Irish who had been Christianized. There are some even who say that Celestius, the Roman advocate, who was Pelagius' associate against Augustine, that he himself was originally from Ireland. But we can't prove that. We don't know. At any rate, Ireland was a wild area from which people occasionally made forays by boat into Britain, seizing and plundering, taking slaves and seizing property, but hardly any, if any, entrance of Christianity until this period. And so under B, we'll call number one the situation at 400 A.D. The situation at 400 A.D. And number two, we'll call Palladius. Palladius was a Roman deacon. Whether Palladius was originally from Britain, we don't know. But there are those who think that he was. At any rate, Palladius was a very active, energetic deacon in Rome. seemed to be a fine man, an able man, and there came a bishop of Rome at this time who felt that it was a shame that Ireland had been left for all these years without any attempt to bring the gospel into it. And so he decided that they should select a man and send him as a missionary to Ireland. And he selected Palladius. And Palladius was well trained for the work, full of zeal, and took some companions with him, left Rome, traveled over to Britain, went across to Ireland, tried for a year and a half to do missionary work there, had practically no success, came back to Britain, sent a letter to the Pope in which he said, the Irish are absolutely hopeless, you can't do anything with them. And he devoted the rest of his life to working among the Christians in the northern part of England. And so the expedition of Palladius represents an attempt of a group to use their human wisdom to make the best selection they could of a man to be the great apostle to carry out a great work. And in this particular instance, the effort dismally failed. But unknown to the Bishop of Rome, in fact, unknown to almost everybody, God was working in an entirely different way. And so we will call number three Patrick. Number three Patrick. Now, Patrick is the name of a man born in Britain, perhaps in North Britain. Some say he was a Scotchman, some say he was a Briton. We don't know much about him. He himself says that his father was a deacon and his grandfather was a presbyter. So he came from a good Christian family. And there's certainly no trace of the Roman idea that ecclesiastical people should be celibate, because Patrick refers as the most natural thing in the world to the fact that his father and his grandfather were thus officials in the church. The word presbyter, you know, is the old Greek word which Roman Catholic Church has contracted into the word priest. But originally, presbyter does not mean a priest, an offerer. It means an elder. It is the Greek word for an older person or an elder. But young Patrick says that he did not know God as a young man. So he says. But I think that when he speaks about it, he is doing like Augustine and like most others who come to really know the Lord. They look back on their youth and they are very much ashamed of their forgetfulness of God. When Patrick was converted, we cannot say. But it would seem that his Christian background and his upbringing had affected him more than he realized. At any rate, when he was 16 years old, a group of marauding Irishmen seized him and carried him off as a slave to Ireland and put him to work there as a herdsman in Ireland. And there out on the hills of Ireland, this young man of Christian background, instead of thinking how terrible it was that these wild people had taken him as a prisoner and were treating him the way they were and forcing him to work for them, instead of that, he received a burden for their soul. He thought about the teaching he'd had as a boy, and he looked to God in penitence for all that he had done wrong. He praised God for having sent Christ to die that he might be saved, but he was filled with an overwhelming desire to reach the Irish people for Christ. And so after 6 years, young Patrick escaped and managed to make his way back, and we don't know whether he went to Britain or to France. There are there's nothing written about Patrick until 200 years later. We have two brief writings by him which have been preserved, or that is, copies of them have been preserved by men who copied them 200 or 300 years later, who said they were copying them from what Patrick had actually written. But we have nothing written about him at the time. We have material about Palladius written, of course, at the time, but nothing about Patrick. in later years, the story of Palladius and of Patrick were confused. And so in the later Middle Ages, it was claimed that the Pope had sent Patrick to Ireland. It is now recognized by all scholars, Roman Catholic as well as Protestant, that this is purely a result of a confusion, that it was Palladius whom the Pope sent to Ireland and not Patrick. There are some today who try to make out that after Patrick escaped, that in Gaul he came under instruction of men who were directly under the supervision of the Pope. Even some will suggest he even made a trip to Rome, but there's absolutely no evidence of anything like that. And the Irish customs were in some ways different, minor ways, but definitely different from the Roman customs, and continued to be so for many hundreds of years. But Patrick, whether in Britain or in Gaul, he studied the Bible, trained himself to be a missionary, and then he went back with a very few companions to Ireland. And his success in Ireland is one of the great missionary stories of all history. Here was God's man at God's time, and the results are almost beyond belief. He worked there for about 50 years, and we have no way of knowing whether the first 10, 15, 20 years were very, very slow and hard and arduous as he gradually gained converts, or whether he gained quite a few immediately. But what we do know is that 50 years later, most of the nation was at least nominally Christian. And not only at least nominally Christian, there were large groups which they called monasteries, much different from monasteries today. They were groups of little huts grouped around a central headquarters where people lived and came together for worship. And not only for worship, for planning how to extend the gospel. We, of course, if we had time to go more into detail, we would talk about Patrick's companion, St. Bridget, a younger person who joined him a little later, but who worked with him and continued to work for 20 years after his death. And then we would mention some of the great saints who came out of Ireland. But I will just summarize it all for the moment, calling number four, the Irish missionary work. The Irish missionary work. And it is the most interesting thing that at this period, when the light of Christianity in North Africa was being put out, and when it was being largely extinguished on the continent, that at this very time, in a new place where there had been none before, there began a new center for the extension of Christianity, from which came one of the greatest missionary works in all history. After a period of a century or so, there were men who were trained and prepared and sent out from Ireland who landed in the wild territory of northern Scotland. And there in Scotland, they made centers from which they went out spreading the knowledge of Christ, and Scotland was largely reached from Ireland. And then these men from Ireland went over to the continent, and they had a great influence in the territory we now call France. And they went into present Switzerland, and they built centers of learning and of missionary work in Switzerland and in northern Italy. And there has been no greater missionary work in the history of the world than the marvelous missionary work that the Irish did before they came under the control of the Bishop of Rome. There is no evidence that they had any connection whatever with the Bishop of Rome during these centuries. Eventually, the time came when an Englishman was Bishop of Rome. He is the only Englishman who ever was made the Bishop of Rome. One English Pope there has been. But this one English Pope in Rome sent a letter to a very licentious Englishman who was King of England, Henry II. And Pope Adrian IV, in 1155, sent a papal bull to Henry II in which he encouraged his intended invasion of Ireland. And he called on him to extirpate the nurseries of vice in Ireland, to enlarge the borders of the Roman Church, to secure the St. Peter from each house the annual pension, which they called Peter's tent. And in 1171, Henry took a strong military force and easily subdued the whole Irish nation, weakened and distracted by civil wars, to British rule, forced the Irish to change the date of their observance of Easter and change certain of their customs, which were different from those observed by the Roman Church, and brought them into subservience to the Church of Rome for the first time in 1170 A.D. This was King Henry II, King Henry II of England, with the Pope having given his blessing to this. And the Irish, who were thus forced to come in line with the Roman Church in 1170, blamed the English for it. And the English held them in subjection. And so when the English became Protestants, the Irish continued to show their hatred of the English by becoming the most loyal supporters of the Pope, as they have been since that time. But the great Irish missionary work, which comes to an end at about 1000 or 1100 A.D., was a work which lasted, thus you see, for 500 or 600 years, and as wonderful a missionary work as the world has ever seen, and a work which was in no way, either in its inception or in its progress, subject to the Church of Rome. Well, that would lead us quite naturally to see the Church of Rome in the 5th century. And this is the century in which the Church of Rome begins to assume an international importance. And so we want to note, number one, factors contributing to its importance. Factors contributing to its importance. And under that, small a is naturally the importance of the city. The importance of the city of Rome. This was the city which had conquered the world, and which had not merely conquered it, but had done it in such a way that it was able to hold the civilized world in subjection for many centuries. And that was partly because they constantly assimilate the people of the conquered area, so that eventually everyone in the Roman Empire was a Roman citizen. But the city of Rome had for many centuries thus had a tremendous prestige, and the most able people were apt to migrate to Rome. And naturally, the Bishop of Rome would have a tremendous name. You remember how Augustine, in his conflict against Pelagianism, was so anxious to have the Bishop of Rome express agreement with him. And when the Bishop of Rome did, Augustine said, two of our great synods have acted, and the Bishop of Rome agrees with us. The cause is finished. Would that the error were speedily finished. And then when a week later he found the new Bishop of Rome disagreed with him, he then said, the Bishop of Rome is wrong, we stand by the truth. And he did not feel himself in any way subservient to the Bishop of Rome, but he felt that the Bishop of Rome had a position and an influence which was of very great importance. So the importance of the city is one reason. Small b, no other city could compete for leadership in the West. But there were several important centers in the East. No other city could compete for leadership in the West. It was the one great city in the West. There were other cities of importance, but no one at this time to compare in any way in size, in wealth, or in importance with Rome. While in the East, you remember that at the Council of Nicaea, they said that the great leaders of the church were the Bishop of Rome, the Bishop of Alexandria, and the Bishop of Antioch. And then Constantinople was founded, and so in the East there were three great cities, Constantinople, Alexandria, and Antioch, each of which felt it was at least as important as either of the other, although Constantinople was the actual capital in the East. But in the West, there was no city to compete with Rome. And so, as far as the West was concerned, the Bishop of Rome had a tremendous advantage in this fact. Then small c, the church at Rome claims to have been founded by apostles. The church at Rome claims to be founded by apostles. No other church in the West could make a similar claim. As early as 200, you remember, Tertullian in North Africa, when he was opposing various heresies, said, you want to know what the truth is? Go to cities where the apostles themselves ministered. Go to Rome, where Peter and Paul were both active, and see what they believe there. And there was no other city in the West which could make the claim that one of the apostles had founded the church in that city. Of course, as far as the Bible is concerned, we find that in Acts it tells us that when Paul came to Rome, he was met by Christians who went out to meet him. So we know he didn't start the church in Rome. It was already started when he came. We have no biblical evidence as to when Peter, whether Peter was ever in Rome or not. But it was believed very early, at least as early as 200, that Peter, as well as Paul, had been in Rome. Of course, we have no doubt that Paul was, because the Bible definitely states it. But this gave Rome a great advantage. And then small d, the removal of the emperor from Rome, had left the bishop as its most powerful citizen. The removal of the emperor from Rome had left its bishop as its most important, most powerful citizen. You remember that in 325, Constantine had moved his capital to Constantinople, the new city which he founded, and which was he called New Rome, but others named it after him, the city of Constantine. And even to this day, they call it Istanbul after Constantine. But this meant that Rome, while still a tremendously important city, rarely had the emperor present in it, and the bishop, the head of the Roman church, was the man who had perhaps more influence than anyone else in the city of Rome. And when the Roman emperor ceased being willing to take the old pagan title of chief bridge builder, which had been used by the head of the pagan religion for many centuries, the bishop of Rome took that title over. And to this day, any Roman bishop always signs his name with a PM after it, Pontifex Maximus, the chief bridge builder. And that title represented the leadership in Rome, the religious leadership. And so the bishop of Rome had a very great importance when Alaric plundered Rome. He spared the Roman churches, the Christian churches, and naturally this gave the Christian church and it gave the bishop greater influence in the eyes of the people in general. And of course, when Leo managed to keep Attila from plundering Rome, they never let people forget that he had succeeded in doing that. And that helped greatly in increasing his influence. And then small e, other Western churches naturally looked to the Church of Rome, the Church at Rome, for advice and for help. Here was the greatest city in the empire. Here was a place where Christianity had been for a longer time than any other place in Western Europe. And when they would have a dispute or a disagreement or a difficulty on some doctrinal point someplace in the West, it was natural for the two contending parties each to seek to get the support of the Bishop of Rome. And in these days, Rome was the wealthiest city in the East, in the West by far. The plunder of the Roman soldiers had been brought to Rome for centuries. And so now, when the barbarians were coming through and there was great need, the Romans were able to give help and in many ways. And so other Western churches naturally looked to the Bishop of Rome and to the Roman church for advice and help. So much for number one, factors contributing to its importance. Number two, the relation of the Roman bishops to the Church of North Africa. I referred to this briefly a minute ago. We went into it in detail last semester. You notice how Innocent and Zosimus, how the North Africans were anxious to have their support against Pelagius. I mentioned to you briefly how there were a number of cases where men who had been dismissed from positions in the Church of Africa, of North Africa, went to Italy and asked the Bishop of Rome to intervene to get them their positions back. And the Bishop of Rome, in several cases, ordered the North African churches to reinstate men whom they had dropped from their position on account of their some immorality or thievery or some wickedness, which, of course, these men denied to the Bishop of Rome that they'd ever been guilty or anything like that. But the Africans complained bitterly against the efforts of the Bishop of Rome to interfere in their affairs, and made strong statements against anybody appealing to an ecclesiastical official in some other area for difficulties which should be settled by those on the ground who could examine the facts and know what the truth was. So there was no attitude in North Africa during Augustine's life of in any way yielding subservience to the Bishop of Rome. Now, of course, after Augustine's death, the situation was entirely different because the Vandals were now holding North Africa, and there were little groups of persecuted Christians instead of large groups of fairly well-to-do Christians. And naturally, they were in just the same situation as people in many parts of the West. Any help they could get from Rome, they were very, very grateful for. And many of them were glad enough after that time to give any statement of subservience to the Bishop of Rome that he might care to ask, if it would get them a little more relief and a little more help in their very disagreeable situation. But North Africa, though one of the most important sections of the Roman Empire up till 430, has been comparatively unimportant historically since that time. But number three, we should note, the comparative insignificance. The comparative insignificance of most of the Roman bishops up until 440 A.D. The comparative insignificance. We have noticed that repeatedly already. That in all these years of the history, of Christian history, four centuries of Christian history, when there were many great Christian leaders in North Africa, in France, in Egypt, in various areas, we do not find a single Roman bishop who ranks as one of the great influential Christian leaders. Not one until you get to 440. The Roman bishops in this early part of the 5th century are just like the ones before. Comparatively insignificant characters. A very strange thing indeed. You would think that in the greatest city in the empire, there would be at least one or two. After 440, we do get in mind Leo the Great, who is one of the great figures of ancient church history. We'll look at him next Tuesday.